Howard Rheingold joins the Plutopia podcast this time. We examine social media, AI and chatbots, media education, good versus bad on the internet, cultural evolution, and tools for thought.
The internet and social media is like a tide that lifts all boats. And that means that the hospital ships and the pirate ships are enabled. If you are the only gay teenager in a small town, or you have a very rare disease that only one in a million people have, then social media is a lifeline for you. If you're the only Nazi in a small town, you can connect with like-minded souls and do bad things. So when I wrote The Virtual Community, when I first wrote the article, Virtual Communities in Whole Earth Review, in 1987, the online population was mostly college students and computer scientists and a few early adopters like all of us. Now it's a significant percentage of the human race. I think it's about, a quarter or a fifth of the human population. And with that, you're gonna get the people who want to do good things and the people who want to do bad things. And it's pretty clear that the ability to do bad things has been vastly amplified.
Welcome everybody to the Plutopia News Network podcast. Today our guest is Howard Rheingold. Howard is a writer, critic, teacher, former editor of Whole Earth Review and the Millennium Whole Earth Catalog, and author of several books, including Virtual Reality, The Virtual Community, and Smart Mobs. I once bought a whole case of copies of Smart Mobs. So welcome, Howard. And I also want to mention that Wendy Grossman, who has been hanging out with Plutopians lately, is also here to ask a few questions. So Howard, how are you?
I couldn't be better.
Excellent, excellent. I wanted to start by talking about online community a bit because, you know, you famously wrote The Virtual Community and as a participant in virtual communities, especially The Well, became authoritative on that particular subject. And I'm just kind of wondering what you're thinking about it now, like three decades after the internet mainstream.
Well, there's more than one answer to that, but I will say I wrote a piece for my Patreon not long ago calling for people to create green spaces online. And what I meant by that is it doesn't look like the massive platforms like Facebook and Twitter that have really sucked the life out of a lot of communities that existed before then. It doesn't look like they're going to go away, although at the moment it looks like Reddit, which actually does have a lot of real communities going there, might be going the way of Dig. However, given that there are so many inexpensive or free tools available, I am urging people to create a forum. You could use discourse.org for that, or you could create a group blog with WordPress, and there are some plugins for WordPress that enable you to do forum-like conversations, or you could have a Discord or a Slack. There are all kinds of tools that are available for you and your particular interest group to avail yourselves of the opportunity to use online communication within your community without the problems both of surveillance capitalism and trolling and all the other awful stuff that can happen online. I think that if we can create a lot of these green spaces and they can survive, that eventually I think it will be a healthier ecosystem. And so I guess the assumption that you might be seeing behind this is that things are not so great in the the social media world in many ways. And I'll have to say at the outset that this took me a while to understand when I first started looking at the way people use communication technology, that the good stuff and the bad stuff are intertwined. The phrase I sometimes use is that the internet and social media is like a tide that lifts all boats. And that means that the hospital ships and the pirate ships are enabled. If you are the only gay teenager in a small town, or you have a very rare disease that only one in a million people have, then social media is a lifeline for you. If you're the only Nazi in a small town, you can connect with like-minded souls and do bad things. So when I wrote The Virtual Community, when I first wrote the article, Virtual Communities in Whole Earth Review in 1987, the online population was mostly college students and computer scientists and a few early adopters like all of us. Now it's a significant percentage of the human race. I think it's about, I don't know, it's about a quarter or a fifth of the human population. And with that, you're going to get the people who want to do good things and the people who want to do bad things. And it's pretty clear that the ability to do bad things has been vastly amplified. There has been for a while kind of an arms race between privacy advocates and social media literacy advocates and the machinery that turns attention into dollars. Now, particularly with the rise of large language models and tools like ChatGPT-3, the ability to fake people out, to create computational micro-targeted propaganda, to suck up all the details of your private life and sell them to other people, that these are all way, way ahead of efforts to try to counter it. I wrote a book 10 years ago called Net Smart. I felt that an answer to the things that are going badly with online media would be literacy, knowing how to do it. That, you know, the four of us and a lot of other people, we more or less can separate the propaganda from the rest of it. And I said more or less because it's becoming harder and harder for anyone to do that. But there are a whole lot of people out there who just don't know the basics, and I don't think it's rocket science. So here we are 10 years later. Is there a widespread education program for people using social media? Are school kids being taught the difference between fake media online and real media online? I don't see it. Certainly there are people doing that, but I'll have to say that I'm not too sanguine about the prospects of our side of this arms race.
Yeah, I wonder who would take the charge there to educate kids. You would think that it would be included in curricula from elementary forward, really. But I, as you say, I don't think that's happening.
Well, there are some reasons for that. And one of them is that the idea of critical thinking, of teaching kids to question assumptions and try to think for themselves, was long ago identified as a communist plot. I know this because my mother was a school teacher, and we're talking, 50, 60 years ago when she was teaching, she got in a lot of trouble for that. And I think it's not difficult to figure out why. It's really not easy to be a teacher or a parent if you encourage your kids to question authority. So, you know, you don't have to think that it's a communist plot to not really be comfortable with what you have to do to teach kids to think critically.
I've been thinking about that question authority thing, though, that there's a couple of ways to do it. I mean, you can be smart about questioning authority and do it critically, but then you have these people on the right. QAnon questions authority, you know, but they're crazy. I mean, they're coming from a place of I hate to call anybody insane, but I think they're coming from a place of insanity. And they're asking the same kind of questions. Is, you know, you'll recall that I had a thing called Fringeware many years ago. This was early internet stuff. And we had that insight that in every community around the country, there could be people who, you know, like in little towns, whatever, there could be people who are kind of thinking outside the box and they don't have anybody else they can talk to, but with the internet, they can connect to people that understand them and will align with them. But as, you know, as you suggested, that also worked for people who were, I don't know how to characterize it, maybe less healthy and productive in their thinking about what they wanted to do. People who were somewhat troubled and finding other troubled people to make trouble.
Yeah. Well, you know, we could spend the whole hour talking about the things that have gone wrong. You know, sexual harassment, sexual predation, racist and anti-Semitic organized brigading of people. There's a litany of stuff that goes wrong. I'll have to say, though, again, at the same time, the global response to pandemics would not have been possible without the internet and social media. I mentioned if you have a disease that only 1 in 1 million people have, well, there are 2 billion people online. That means there are 2,000 others online who have that disease. So it's a lifeline, and it's a threat at the same time. And I think, you know, if we're going to try to learn any lessons from this going forward, I think you need to kind of think proactively about where new social communication technologies in particular could go wrong. And I can't attribute this. It might be Ethan Zuckerman, but I'm not sure. But someone recently said a good thing, way to think about new technologies, new social technologies, is what would 4chan do with it? And so, you know, I think now we're beginning to think about where are we going with AI? I think that's a good question to raise there. I don't really have the expertise to have a judgment on whether general artificial intelligence is going to be an existential threat to humans, but it certainly can be a powerful tool for bad actors. And, you know, so what do you do about that? Well, how about thinking about that in advance? Not that I have an answer other than, you know, we ought to think about it. There ought to be, as there is, a more of a public discourse about where AI may be heading.
Howard, I have to give credit to you with my early education online. I believe you had a BBS, and I got onto it and transgressed. And you gave me a very pithy comeback of how you were supposed to behave online. It wasn't, you know, nasty or anything. It was just a straight, you don't do these, you don't promote your products on my BBS. And I kept those words to heart. It took them to heart, and they saved me many times in my later endeavors online. I have to thank you for that, because people in the early days really didn't have any clue of what you could do, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, what was good manners, what was bad manners. And it was nice of you to share that.
Well, norms are ways that populations can enforce behavioral rules without having a law or law enforcement. It's like, you know, people frown at you, even strangers, if you don't clean up your dog poop on the sidewalk while they're watching. That's a norm. There is a famous incident, Wikipedia, I think it, well, I know it as the September that never ended. I think it's Eternal September on Wikipedia, but Usenet used to have norms. Usenet being this kind of global BBS system, without going into any detail, that had tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people in the world participating. And they had some norms. One of the norms was, before you ask questions of experts, read our frequently asked questions. Don't type in all caps. Don't try to flog your commercial product. The old timers would pass along the norms to newcomers, and often not in a polite way. And then AOL put 3 million people on the internet one night without any kind of instruction on norms. And it became impossible for the old timers to educate the newcomers. So I think that there's, you know, we're seeing the deterioration of norms on Twitter now. It's, you really can't enforce norms when there's actually no real sanctions for the worst offenders.
Well, the other problem is that somebody comes along who doesn't care about norms, like Elon Musk or like Trump, and the system of relying on norms breaks. And what you hope that whoever's in charge of the U.S. is doing is making it harder to break those norms.
Yeah, I'm afraid that also connects with this business of there being so much misinformation and disinformation out there, and that's being embraced by authoritarian political movements around the world. And if you go back to the last chapter of The Virtual Community, which is 1992, I don't know, was that 25, 30 years ago, I called it disinformocracy, and I tried to foresee the different ways that things could go wrong. And one of them I really got from Guy Debord, who wrote The Society of the Spectacle, and Jean Baudrillard, who wrote about simulations, which is the idea that as our media become better and better at faking reality, we begin to live in an unreality, in a simulation that is created not by most people, but by people who have the means to manipulate what we believe. And what we're seeing in terms of norms is, you mentioned QAnon. Just it's not just that there are false things happening. It's that the beliefs in reality are beginning to be fogged. And I don't know where that's going to go. How do you teach people to fact check if there are so many unfacts disguising as facts?
Alternate facts.
You know, people quote do their own research about things like vaccines, and they come up with all kinds of bogus material to back it up. So I think, you know, I was one of many who celebrated the kind of the fragmentation of the monopoly on attention that the internet brought. I mean, we used to have in the U.S. three major television networks and three or four major newspapers, and a fairly small number of people dictated the news that a large number of people got every day. And then suddenly every desktop and now every telephone can broadcast and be a site of information. And many-to-many communications have been a great boon, and also part of this fogging of reality that's going on. I don't know the answer.
It sounds like we need a way to watermark reality like we do in certain files. It's hard to tell what's real anymore because it's so, if you will, realistic in its development.
I mean, you know, anti-vaxxers, they have some reality to deal with. There are unknown things about vaccines. But then you've got flat earthers who are, you know, the internet and social media have given them a great opportunity to connect with each other and have a platform. It's just, it's really weird it's scary what people believe, because, you know, it used to be that people thought that plagues were caused by foreigners or Jews poisoning the well or witches. When it was discovered that if you boiled your water and killed the dangerous microorganisms in it, your kids wouldn't die, we had a reality to deal with. You know, the reality of the scientific process, and that's coming under attack as well.
Yeah, there was so much more respect for that, but now scientific process is being viewed by some people the way we used to view superstition. You know, as unreliable and even hazardous.
You know, at the same time, I talked about green space. There, this doesn't mean that people have stopped doing good things about improving the internet. I just see that the bad stuff is so appalling that it gets all the attention.
But it's sort of like what Joanna Bryson was saying about AI, that it's a tool, it's a thing that you use, and we shouldn't start thinking of it as a human thing, but we should remember that it's created by humans and operated by humans, and really, you got to look at the humans. The AI is not responsible when it screws up. The human who made the AI is responsible when it screws up. And I think that's also true of the internet. I mean, the internet is a tool. We built the tool, and it like a shovel. You can use a shovel to dig a hole. You can also use it to bludgeon your neighbor. And either use is possible. How do you ensure digging of the hole is seen as the correct use? It's a moral question, I think.
Yeah, you know, if you try to dig down to the foundations of this, it really comes down to fundamental religious beliefs about who people are. Are humans born in sin and have to be saved from it and disciplined from it, or are humans born neutral and are shaped by our culture and our environment? And I don't think we're ever going to see a day, or nor really should we see the day when there's a universal agreement about that. But I'll have to say, just to go back to this discussion about AI, which I don't really know a great deal about, but, you know, if it wasn't for the internet and social media, we would not have large language models. Where do you think they got the large language from? It's from all of the things that all of us have put on the internet. And so, yes, it's a tool, but, you know, they used to think AI consisted of making programs that could do tasks like recognize vision and speech. It turned out when Google started using CAPTCHAs that they were able to train their visual recognition by using the byproduct of human activity. And large language models are kind of the molecules, the elements of them are everything on the internet, including a lot of bad stuff, including a lot of art that was created by people who didn't give permission for it to be used. I think it's too late to argue about things like copyright in that respect, but I think we have to understand that this tool is not only a tool that humans use, but it's made from humans. It's made from human activity, and the computer part of it really wouldn't be able to do what it does without all the things that people do.
I have to bring up the naughty elephant in the room. If you think back of how things online became popular, email, the web, Usenet, it was well known among folks like us who got early on to computing and such. But when porn became available on these channels, then it went through the roof. And now I see that the makers of realistic sex dolls are going to start, they claim, putting AI into the sex dolls. And that made my mind just kind of melt down. But that seems to be the way all of these technologies have become ultra popular, not through, you know, learned discourse, but the arrival of porn.
Teledildonics.
I seem to recall that the reason VHS was more successful than Beta was that Sony was very prudish about allowing porn to be on Beta. But that's not the only reason things became popular. I mean, you know, Usenet had a lot of stuff on it that wasn't porn. You know, it's just if you're counting by images versus text, obviously in terms of traffic, it's going to swamp the server. And I recall that the University of Delft had a particularly large archive of porn in the early 90s, and they had to take it down because it was most of the traffic to the university.
Well, I'm somewhat neutral on the porn issue. Is it harmful? Is it not harmful? I don't know. What we do know is that child sexual abuse and exploitation of images of it are in a golden age with the internet as we know it. And I have no evidence of it, but I've heard that that recently it's exploded a lot on Twitter. I mean, I've seen porn on Twitter, but I haven't seen the child abuse part. So, you know, I think that's maybe one thing that almost every human agrees on, that we shouldn't sanction anything that amplifies the ability for people to abuse children. Clearly, that's not working in some ways. Although I don't know about the efforts to catch those people, and I certainly suspect that there are a lot of them. Again, we're kind of getting into a litany of all the ways that things have gone wrong online. I think it's good to face that. I think it's also good to understand that if you take that away, you're going to take away a lot of important, useful stuff. I think science and medical science would be hamstrung without it.
Well, we've both been, and probably all of us have been members of communities that are interesting and productive and cordial. You know, sometimes there's flame wars, but often cordial. I know the well has been a big part of my life, and I know yours for decades now. And I've made some relationships there that are like lifelong friendships, even with people that I never see. I met a 30-year friend the other day face-to-face for the first time. It was somebody that I met on the well. So the internet gives us a platform that allows us to transcend geography and allows us to connect with people that where we can form bonds and we can form friendships, and we can also do productive work and creative work online. So there's so much good that comes from the internet, and I tend to think it vastly outweighs the bad stuff. It's hard not to think about the bad stuff, especially right now, because it's kind of in our face. But it has been, I think, a great net positive.
You know, I read a very interesting article that was published quite recently. The title is What Makes Us Smarter? And Joe Henrich, H-E-N-R-I-C-H, was the principal author of it. And he says that, you know, it's not particularly our big brains that have enabled humans to build what no other species has been able to create. It's our talent and I guess hunger for connection and communication and forming networks and using those networks to leverage learning. So, you know, in biological evolution, if a creature has a slightly better ability to see or some other trait, then over millions of years, the descendants of that creature will come to dominate. With cultural evolution, if somebody discovers how to make a fire, they can teach everybody else in the tribe, and everybody else in the future of that tribe knows how to make fire. And then, you know what? A second person might come along and say, you know, if you put your meat on the fire and cook it, it's going to be a lot easier to digest. And then everybody knows that. So cultural evolution does operate in a similar way to Darwinian evolution, but much, much faster. And it happens through two things. It happens through social networks and communication networks, and it also happens through teaching. So in some ways, we're the species that teaches. So what we're talking about now, the use of the internet and the evolution of social media, is really a connection, an extension of that. And it really brings, you know, I call my book Smart Mobs in the year 2000, and I really wish I had explicitly stated that a smart mob is not necessarily a wise mob, although I did write about the dangers of it. Being smarter does not necessarily mean you're going to be a good person. The leader of the Nazi mobile killing squads had two PhDs. So we're getting smarter. Well, how do we get wiser? Or how does whatever wisdom we have, how is it deployed in a way that somehow it can buffer or even win over the tide of antisocial behavior?
Yeah, humans are good at evolving, but sometimes our evolution is not so good. Like the drone used to be a little kid toy. Now they have weapons, they bomb, they kill. And a number of other technologies have been that way as well. The airplane was a charming little thing that flew around till they realized you could drop a bomb from it. So there's evolution. I don't know if that's evolution or devolution.
Well, I think it's clear that a phone, a plane that can be used in warfare is intelligent. It's not necessarily humane. And so, you know, I think we need to make that distinction that becoming smarter does not necessarily make everything better. I think we want smarter doctors. We want smarter builders of transportation technologies. But making everybody smarter is not going to make the world necessarily a better place.
Yeah, one of the first things you wrote about was tools for thought. And I think you were writing about computers and how they can amplify our capabilities, our ability to think and our ability to learn. But there's also the question of whether we can use computers to amplify our wisdom.
You know, there have been people who tried, and there's a conference that the name of which escapes me at the moment, in which people try to get together to talk about things like that. There was a couple of decades ago, there's a couple by the name of Peter and Trudy Johnson Lenz, who they invented the word groupware, and they had their own server, and they called it Awakening Technology. And they used to have kind of Sangha-like meetings in which people tried to share at a deeper level. And, you know, clearly there are many ways that people do share at a deeper level. When you're talking about people who are caregivers for people with Alzheimer's or people who have cancer. The discussions that they have are a lot deeper often than what you see in more so superficial places. My ideas that led to Tools for Thought really came from my encounter with Doug Engelbart, who had a heck of a time convincing people that computers should be or could be used to think and communicate. And he had, in addition to the things that his team invented, he had this framework he called HLAMT, Humans Using Language Artifacts, Methodology, and Training. And in our conversations over the years since Tools for Thought, he often pointed out that the artifacts are literally millions of times more powerful than what he had in the 1960s. But the methodology and the training really hasn't gone along with that. And I think that connects to my what I had to say about literacy, that having a powerful tool is going to be used differentially by people who know how to use it and people who don't know how to use it. And again, I'm not sanguine about there being a mass education about it, but if you, on a theoretical level, if you talked about what can we do about these powerful tools that can be misused, I think educating people about how to use them is one thing that can be done and is relatively inexpensive.
Yeah, it occurs to me that this problem we have, I think we do have a significant problem with propaganda. I mean, I should state that up front. And I think that the way to address that problem is not on the transmission side, but on the receiving side. If you can make people smart enough to spot the manipulation and you can neutralize it thereby, then that sort of defuses the bomb.
I think I'm going to disagree with that.
I think of
the promulgation of disinformation and misinformation online as a problem as complex as computer security. And to solve computer security, which we haven't managed to do, you need everything. You need educated users, but you also need better design, and you need ways to create friction that make it harder for the attacker to spread misinformation or to hack into your system. One of the big mistakes in security is when people say people are the weakest link. That's often true, but the answer is not to fix the user, not necessarily to fix the users, because you don't want to blame the user for being fooled. You want to make it easier for them to say report something that they're not certain about, or to spot things, or you want to choke it off at the source. I mean, yes, it's great to say yes, people should be educated, but you have to meet them.
I don't think that would be blaming the user for being fooled. It's more like making the user less likely to be fooled.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's an arms race.
Yeah, understood.
Yeah, and we the humans seem to be losing it. But you know, education is an institution. Learning is something that humans do, and whether or not it revolutionizes education, clearly the internet has revolutionized learning. If you ask a 14-year-old anywhere in the world, how do you learn to configure a web server, play a ukulele, scuba dive, they're going to say, oh, I'll do a search on YouTube. Until pretty recently, schools had the monopoly on learning, except for, you know, a few dedicated autodidacts. You wanted to learn, you had to go to school. Now you've got the lectures of the best universities in the world. You've got all the texts you could possibly want. You've got communication, media, like forums and chat. Now we're seeing people using ChatGPT as a tutor. The the tools and the material. Yes, is that a good idea or not? That's a good question. Well, I think, again, if you know what you're doing. So my daughter designs mobile learning content. It's a combination of chat bots and Slack and video conference. She is amplifying her ability to use that by using ChatGPT, by saying, you're an instructional designer, and these are the ideas you need to get across. Then, of course, she knows what she's doing, so she can throw out the bad stuff and use the good stuff. Again, it's the methodology and training part of it. It's a flawed tool, but if you understand how to use the flaws, then you can get ahead with it. But anyway, to get back to that, peer-to-peer learning online is something that happens every day for millions of people. That's something that just didn't happen before. What we don't really have is a widespread understanding about how do you go about doing it. So that's 2011, I created something called Peeragogy. If you go to peeragogy.org, peeragogy.org, I started this, but I really dropped out of that community a few years ago, and it has been taken up by people around the world to create a handbook for peer learning. So one of the things that I am pretty optimistic about is the potential of the internet for people to learn both within, but mostly outside of the educational institutions.
That's funny. It reminded me, I often compare the internet to the Junior Woodchuck's guidebook. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Yeah, and Huey, Dewey, and Louie would refer to that, and they found the answer to any question that came up in the Junior Woodchuck's guidebook. The internet is just like that, but you can also find a lot that's not correct or not true. And this, you know, this comes up a bit in, I've worked some with, you know, the participatory medicine patient communities thing. And in patient communities, amazing things can happen. Patients can become a kind of like group mind about their condition. And, you know, each person is different. So each person has maybe a different manifestation of a particular disease. And if you bring a lot of those people together, they can derive real insights about therapies that it would be hard to create in any other kind of environment. And they can conduct research together and so forth, but they can also spread misinformation about the condition, and they can scare the hell out of each other about the condition. So there's always a potential downside. And I guess this is just a struggle. It's a wicked problem. It's a struggle we're always going to have between the smart use of things and the less smart use of things.
Well, I've always felt that a peer medical community for people with ailments would be much better if it included some paid medical authorities, doctors and nurses, and you know, just maybe a pool of consultants that you could, you know, have. Remember that in, what was it, Annie Hall, the Woody Allen movie where he pulled Marshall McLuhan in to
yeah.
I think having the ability to have people on tap who have good credentials about their particular specialty, who can be called into a conversation like that. That would be like having the moderator rods in a nuclear reactor to keep the bad stuff from running out of control.
Don't you think though, that if you want to look back, that peer-to-peer learning did exist before the internet? I mean, I think of AA, for example, as an example of peer-to-peer learning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the education of freed slaves in the U.S. happened on a peer-to-peer basis. I think it was each one teach one was what they called that. Again, you know, the internet simply amplifies that.
I came across a cool story. A friend of mine has written a book on how vaccines work. And he's got a story in it about variolation, which was an early form of vaccination. That was like giving somebody cowpox instead of smallpox. to combat smallpox, that actually technique was spread in Boston because a woman asked her slave why he hadn't gotten smallpox.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, there's a movement in some parts of this country, Texas, where we are particularly, parent empowerment taking over the education of children is considered endangered because the parents don't have a say in what they're teaching. So they're banning books, they're banning courses of study that they figure will upset the children. And that's something just scares the hell out of me, because all it takes is a bunch of clueless parents getting in charge to send a whole generation off into the dustbin.
It turns out that it's 11 of them, that almost all of these book banning laws had been pushed by 11 parents. Amazing.
Well, the story I read was that there are 11 parents who filed most of the complaints, but they're not necessarily filing them just on their own behalf, that other people are happy for them to file for them and take the heat. So I'm not clear that it's really just 11 people who want these things banned. On the other hand, it's very frustrating to watch, particularly, you know, from outside the country. You sort of look at it and say, are you guys crazy now?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. I've tried to kind of see the parents' side of this, where they have a feeling that what's happening with their kids is something that's outside their control, and they want to get more control over it, right? They're afraid their kids are being taught things that they really don't want them to learn. And I think there is a valid question about the parent's role and what input a parent should be able to have. And it's hard for us to address that when, this Steve Bannon thing, you know, he talks about flood the zone with shit. Well, they're flooding the zone. There's a lot of very sort of emotional, reactive discussion about banning books versus parental like involvement, and whether parents should be able to remove books and so forth. But I think one question is, what role should a parent have in their child's education, and to what extent should that education be divorced from what the parents desire?
Boy, that's another one of your wicked problems. I
know, it's hard.
I don't have an answer to that, but I do remember from my own experience that when these kids learn that they have been misled, they're not going to believe a lot of things that they really ought to believe. So our generation, boomers' generation, you know, it turned out that we found out that the conditions for African Americans in our country were a lot worse than we saw on television, and that maybe the United States wasn't always right when we went to war, and that marijuana is not going to kill you. Well, that generalized into people taking drugs that destroy their lives, and people making a lot of, just the rebellion that we saw really came, I think, from not just righteous indignation about the injustices, but what happens when you feel like people have been pulling the wool over your eyes, especially if they're your parents. I don't think that everyone who is being miseducated is going to see the light, but it's really hard to keep adults from having access to that kind of material.
Yeah, I experienced that whole thing of learning how bad race relations were when I was a child in our hometown where John and I grew up. The courthouse, the county courthouse, had drinking fountains that were labeled white and colored. And I didn't know what that meant. I went up to the colored one. I was going to get a drink. And the sheriff comes up behind and grabs me by the shoulder because he was out there talking to my dad. He said, "You can't do that. Don't you understand?" I didn't understand. And he tried to explain it to me, but not really explain it to me. And it took me asking my mom, "What was that all about?" And, "Well, that's only for those other folks, the colored folks." I, "What color?" And it just, you know, so that conversation spiraled out of control. But that's when I learned that there were different treatments for different people.
I'm a little younger than you are. So, you know, I think I went through a lot of my life thinking that a lot of race relations had improved a lot. And one of the things that I really learned in the last five years on Twitter, up until November 2022, I kind of have a cutoff when Musk took over, was, you know, that you, in the States at least, you don't call police if there's a black person present because they could end up dead. And I had never known that. And so there's a lot still that I think if you live, you know, in a somewhat privileged life, you don't see.
Yeah. And I think, you know, particularly if you're a kid, it's pretty easy to enclose your world. I just think that you can't keep doing that forever.
I got to tell you, that's been hitting me really hard lately. There's just so much that, I mean, you know, over the years, you become more and more aware of your own privilege, really. And I have led a very privileged life, and it never occurred to me, you know, and late in life, suddenly I'm aware of how much privilege I've had. And you know, the irony of it is that I see a bunch of people now, like the GOP MAGA people, wanting to deny that, wanted to deny any discussion of privilege or of like systemic racism or any of those things. And the internet should open those doors for people, but they're also using the internet in some cases pretty effectively to slam those doors. Another wicked problem.
Well, you know, there's one kind of nice thing happening at the moment. In the background, I've got some pictures on from the Miami courthouse where Trump is appearing. And there are protesters outside. And some of them are for Trump and some of them are against Trump. And nobody's hitting anybody. They all seem to be milling around peacefully. And, you know, that's a start, right?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that as well. And I think the fact that so many people have been prosecuted and sentenced for their role in January 6th, that the people who were brave then about showing up to cause trouble they're not inclined to want to be identified because they know if they break the law, they might be busted for it. So I think that we're getting kind of far afield here, but I think that there are two things that are kind of, you know, pulling at each other, which is the institutions of law, which are often imperfect and even unjust, are really the only bulwark that a democracy has against the mob. And that at the same time, we've got these militias and conspiracy groups that are ready to go violent, having more and more rhetoric. So clearly the rhetoric creates an atmosphere in which violence can happen, but we're also seeing maybe some of the dampening of that violence. I read something yesterday about people mistaking popular uprisings for revolutions, that revolutions only happen when the military goes along with the populace, that in France in 1789 and in Russia in 1917, that if the law enforcement and armed forces had not gone over to the side of the people, then, you know, it doesn't matter how many rednecks with guns you've got, they're not going to defeat the military. So,
yeah, I read that too.
So our hope is that the military is not on board with the Proud Boys.
Well,
evidently it's not. Surely there's people in the military who are on board with that, but in general, I don't think that they're.
You know,
I don't think we should worry about that.
One comment on Twitter right after January 6th was, well, after Biden took office, was that one thing he could do by an executive order is he could stop the playing of Fox News continuously on military bases, and that would be actually a helpful thing.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, people want to blame the internet for everything, but really, if you look at the influence of Rupert Murdoch and Fox News and his control over the Australian local press and, you know, the Times and the Sun in Britain and the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal in the U.S., I mean, that is really a much bigger problem.
Well, you've got Rupert Murdoch and you've got Vladimir Putin and you've got a lot of people who have a kind of autocratic sensibility and who have a lot of money and who, you know, who really, they don't want a level playing field. They don't want equality. They don't want democracy, any of those things. But I think to bring it back around to kind of what we were talking about originally and our subject of discussion, I wonder what we as people who are professionals who have been involved with the internet for a long time and who understand social media and who understand online community and who understand communication to some extent, what can we be doing now? How can we try to undo some of the polarization that we're experiencing? How do we fix the world?
Well, you know, I don't have an answer to that one, but I really think it would be useful for the Office of Technology Assessment to be reconstituted. In 1986, I participated in a study that they had about the future of communications. So 1986, future of communications. The report is online. It's called Critical Connections. And they did a really good job of bringing a real cross section of experts and citizens from all parts of the country and all parts of the political spectrum from cities and country and facilitated some very useful discussions. The people who were in the audience for that and the people who read the reports were the 20-something aides to Congress who told them what, according to their values, how they ought to think about different issues. It was a pretty small budget, something like $20 million, and it was zeroed out by the Gingrich Congress. I think it's become much more clear to the population and even to Congress that the issues of technology have everything to do with governance and the economy and health and education, and that they don't know very much about it. I mean, very, very few of them. You know, Al Gore got a bad deal because he was one of the only people in the Senate who really understood what the potential of the internet was. I don't think we can hope to, nor should we, hope to elect political leaders who are primarily technology experts, but they certainly ought to have some expertise other than the lobbyists telling them what the effects in a nonpartisan way of new technologies, particularly new communication technologies, might be.
So we have a few minutes. We have a few minutes left. If we had this conversation a year from now, How do you think it may have changed between now and a year from now, the things we've been talking about?
Well, I think one thing we're seeing with the large language models is that AI, which decades is accelerating, and that in the next year it's going to be a lot more powerful. And I talked about Engelbart saying that, you know, several decades later the artifacts were millions of times more powerful. The large language models come in versions, and they're going to be increasingly powerful, and people using them and figuring out what goes wrong with them and how to make them work more efficiently, that's certainly going to happen. And here in San Francisco, so many of the people who left San Francisco because it's expensive and they could work remotely from other parts of the world, they're coming here because of the AI wave. So, you know, the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, it really is a cycle where the bust of one technology-based economy seeds the boom of the next one, you know, starting with video games, when, you know, video games and personal computers and the internet and mobile telephones. And now we've got AI happening, and they're calling the Hayes Valley here Cerebral Valley, because that's where all the startups are. And I'm getting all these invites to where they're inviting 200, 300, 400, 500 people to these forums about it. So there's a lot happening right now in a ferment around the AI business. And I think a year from now, we're going to see a lot coming from that. You know, we already have this, the release of ChatGPT was just a few months ago, and now we're seeing just dozens and dozens of apps and plugins that people are coming up with. So I think that's the one thing that can be said with confidence.
So AI is a catalyst for a lot of activity, and I believe that if we were to get another Office of Technology Assessment or a similar thing, it will probably be because AI has spooked people.
Yeah, as it should. I think all the things we're talking about illustrate that shiny new tools that enrich people's lives and make people's fortunes some years down the line turn out to have a seamy side to them. Let's start thinking about that a little bit earlier. Not that I know what the answer is, but I think not talking about it is a problem.
So Howard, we're at the end of our hour. So I think we have to wrap up, but we really appreciate you joining us today, and we hope you'll come back again.
Oh, of course. You know, we really didn't talk very much about the mechanics of online communities and
That's why. That's what I think we can talk about the next time.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. Good.
If you're willing to come back, we'll invite you back in a few weeks.
Always for you, John.
Oh, thank you so much.
Nice to see you all.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.